Friends, before we begin this episode, I want to extend you a personal invitation to join me here on the campus of Midwestern Seminary and Spurgeon College for our upcoming Spring Preview Day. On April the 11th, you'll be able to meet our faculty, enjoy some incredible Kansas City barbecue, tour the Spurgeon Library, take in all that is Midwestern Seminary and Spurgeon College, and also be entered to win incredible gifts like a new MacBook Air, which we trust will position you well as you prepare to be a student. For more information, please go to mbts.edu. That is mbts.edu. As I said, today is a different service. We occasionally have conversations or panels in chapel, as opposed to the preaching of the word, which we customarily do every Tuesday and Wednesday. And today is one such service. We're delighted today to host a friend to many of us and a friend of this institution, Tim Challies, for a conversation. Many of you know Tim. He hosts a very popular website and posts articles on a near daily basis there. Also has produced a number of videos, docuseries type projects on his website as well that many of us know. Many of us know him from his books, his writings as well over the years, and has written a number of books, tend to related around Christian living, the Christian life. And many of us know him most recently for his book that he wrote about sorrow and about dealing with sorrow through the loss of his son a little over 4 years ago, who's now with the Lord. So today's conversation is going to be really stewarding that conversation, that journey the Lord has had Tim and his family on through the loss of his son, Nick, who went to be with the Lord in late 2020. And so the Lord has given Tim through that a very strategic ministry through his book, Seasons of Sorrow, and through speaking in venues like this. So for us, as even Tim and I visited last night about how to steward the conversation today most helpfully, we'll be talking about that story and hearing from Tim about what the Lord has done in his life, his family's life over these last 4+ years. So for us, not only to be strengthened about our own seasons of sorrow, past, present, and future, but also as those of us who minister, as so many of us in the room do or will, minister to those who have experienced loss as well, how we can do that most effectively. So, Tim, we're thankful for the gift of your time traveling down from Canada. That's risky business these days. Coming down from Canada, the prospects of statehood and all the rest, as we were joking about last night. But we're thankful you're here and that the gift of your time yesterday and today to be with us. So why don't you come join me on the platform and we'll have our conversation. Friends, join me in welcoming Tim Challies. Tim, we're really thankful to have you on the campus today and to, again, encourage those in the room and beyond the room via this conversation. And before we hop right into the book and into the story that is the book and the story that prompted the book, I do want to help orient some of the room who may not be as familiar. As we were reflecting at dinner last night, we are getting older. Mm. And so when your website really became very popular in the early 2000s, that's now, you know, a couple decades removed. So I don't want to assume that our students, especially our Spurgeon College students, that they would be current on your ministry and what the Lord has given to you these past two decades. So give us a word of biography and a little bit of a Tim Challies orientation.
Sure. So one difference I've noted over the last few years is that when I speak at a venue like this, people will come up afterwards and say, my mom wanted me to have a picture taken with you so I can send it to my mom. So I realize now I'm sort of running one generation ahead, as I'm sure you understand. So born and raised in Canada, had the privilege of being raised in a Christian home. My parents were new believers. When I was born, they had been saved into Pentecostalism. And on their honeymoon, they decided to visit Switzerland and bumped into a guy there named Francis Schaeffer and spent actually a year with the Schaeffer family and returned from that experience completely transformed. So I was raised in a Reformed context and had the privilege of being raised around the gospel. Got married young at 21 and the Lord granted us 3 children. Along the way, I started to do some writing kind of recreationally and ended up writing a blog that was right at the cusp of when that was
new. And about what year is that?
2003. That was new at the time and exciting. I know it's not so anymore, but at the time that was the new technology. And so people started reading it, and that just sort of gave me a platform to speak to the Christian church on various issues.
And so then for about 20 years, you've maintained your website, which has been your primary employment, primary source of, I guess, of ministry output.
Yeah.
Over the years, you've written some books. Give us a few words about the books you've written.
Sure. Yeah, I've written on a variety of subjects. My very first book was about spiritual discernment. After that, I wrote a book about pornography, really targeted to young men. I've written a book on productivity, I've written about about church history. I've written books that are theology, but combined with infographics. And then, of course, written Seasons of Sorrow. My latest book is a book of poetry, and all the historic poetry, not original poetry, but all the poems are prayers. And so it's meant to just be poems you can pray to the Lord to help you in your devotional life. So I'm sort of all over the place.
And say a word about the video project you've undertaken.
Sure. I've done two big video projects, around the world video projects. The first was called Epic. Nobody wanted to pay for it, so we just made it free on YouTube, so you can watch it there. It's traveling around the world, finding historical objects, and then trying to tell the story of the Christian church through those historical objects. It had this distinction of launching the week that Amazon stopped shipping anything except pandemic supplies during COVID, and so it sort of released into a void, unfortunately, after all that work.
Yeah.
And then last year, I traveled the world again, this time to worship in churches in 12 different countries, churches that are true to the gospel and founded upon scripture, but also deeply embedded in their own culture. And so going out into the bush in Zambia and meeting with a distinctly Zambian church that would be very familiar in its style of worship, a good Baptist, Reformed Baptist church, and yet distinctly Zambian in much of its worship. And the only church I've been to where one of the elements of the service was all the moms dancing together. Maybe you can imagine your church if all the moms got up and did a dance together.
We're trying not to imagine that.
We're trying not. Yeah, exactly. And yet for them, that was a very normal and expected way of celebrating what the Lord was doing. So just a fascinating journey around the world. That one will be out in September.
So for those who would like to know about your ministry, some of these even projects you've undertaken, your books, where can they find that?
Chalice.com is the best place to start. That's my website. Or most of the social media, just do whatever, facebook.com/Chalice or whatever social media.
You're posting short essays there. How regularly now?
Every day I post links to other websites. I love doing that, directing people to good content out there on the internet. And then several times a week, I post an original article as well, mostly devotional type writing, just things meant to help you in the Christian life.
And before we get to a more focused conversation, give us just a little bit of update on Canadian Christianity. What's going on in the churches there? What are you encouraged by? How should we be praying? That sort of thing.
Yeah, thanks for asking. The church in Canada is doing really well. The Lord's doing some really interesting things right now. One of the strange facts about Canada is we tend to relate more to one another in the United States than across the country. It's a very wide country, and everybody's strung out along the border with the U.S., so we're more likely to meet other Canadians at a conference or a seminary in the United States than in Canada. And we're trying to adjust that a little bit and have Canadians spend more time together, since there's obviously so much unity and so much co-laboring we can do together that's not as possible over the border. But we've had a lot of, Canada's a nation of immigration right now. One of the facts of Canada is Canadians won't have babies. Our birth rate is very low. And so to avoid the country just completely collapsing, we need immigration. And so we welcome people from around the world. Many of those people are coming to Canada as Christians, bringing their faith with them. And so the churches in most cities reflect that massive diversity and people from a variety of nations and backgrounds all worshiping the Lord together and carrying out his work. So there's few things more encouraging than someone coming to Canada from India and saying, this is my new home, this is my new mission field. And I believe what you believe. I'm in all the way. Let's do the Lord's work here.
And so, Tim, and you're living and serving in the Toronto area more specifically. Mm-hmm. And so in the city itself, what are you seeing?
Yeah, there's a real interest in religion, real interest in the gospel. One thing you find is that when people immigrate, most of the people who immigrate to the country are not the least bit afraid or offended to discuss religion. Many of them have never heard of Jesus. And so the people there are they're not unbelievers because they've heard the gospel and rejected it. They're unbelievers because they've never heard the gospel. And so when you're speaking to people, I'm Muslim, I have the same taxi driver who takes me to the airport. I invited him to come to church and he came to church. He had never been in a Christian church before. And so this was a new thing for him, new experience. And I think he really enjoyed it. It was a good experience for him. But when you're meeting people, talking to people, we have an evangelism team that goes around the neighborhood around our church. They'll be speaking to people who have never heard of Jesus. They only know Jesus as a swear word. They don't know him as a flesh and blood person, not to mention the savior of the world. So great ministry opportunities.
So I want to begin to move the conversation towards your personal story, journey, and then we'll get to the Seasons of Sorrow book. But give us a little bit of the Brock Hunters, your family, how long you've been married, the ages of your girls, and,
sure.
And kind of where you, the story that brings us to 2025.
Yeah, so I got married when I was 21. My wife was 22. We've been married now for 26 years. The Lord blessed us with three children. So Nick was our eldest. He would be 25 in a couple of weeks. And then Abby is 22, and she's married to Nathan, and they just had a son named Finnegan, who's my pride and joy right now. And then
to your granddad.
I'm a grandfather, yep. Yeah, which highly recommended. grandfathering, it's amazing. And then my youngest, Michaela, is at Boyce College. All my kids went to Boyce. My son also went to Southern. And so she's doing well there. Both my girls in biblical counseling. Abby graduated. Michaela is still there now.
So then bring us towards 2019, 2020.
Mm-hmm. So 2020, you remember, was peak COVID. And we live in a different country. And at that time, our countries were putting all sorts of barriers between international travel. And so Nick, because he had a student visa, was able to go down to Southern where he was studying. He was in his junior year at Boyce and just doing the concurrent program as well. So also studying at the seminary. Abby was in her freshman year and also on a student visa, so able to go down. You remember, you may not remember, but at the time there were pretty goofy rules in place between our two countries. Like it was illegal to drive across the border, but you were free to fly across the border. Don't know why, but that was the rule. So anyways, they were down there and we were on the far side of the border. And then we come to the evening, November 3rd, which is when we got the news that Nick had first had a medical problem. We just got a text from one of their friends saying that Nick had collapsed and they didn't think he was breathing. And just the news sort of got worse and worse from there until we got a call from a doctor telling us that they had not been able to save him.
And so he's a young man, your son, your only son.
Yeah.
Healthy, no previous medical concerns or issues. This is a phone call absolutely out of the blue.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. He'd just gotten engaged to a sweet young lady, whole life kind of stretched out before him. They just planned their wedding date. And we're really just excited about the future. He was very excited to be a pastor. He had known for a long time that's what he wanted to do, what he felt the Lord wanted him to do, that had been affirmed by the elders of our church. And had decided to go to Southern to get his training and was really excelling in his studies there. And so really looking forward to the future.
There's so many different aspects to this that it would be healthy for us to reflect on together. You've been so generous with this from a ministry standpoint. So as we talk today, brothers and sisters, there's nothing here that Tim has not already reflected on in print and in multiple, many countless other public settings. I know that's a part of even your story, the stewardship of this from a ministry standpoint. And you told me last night at dinner that reality was first really planted in your heart and mind from a friend. Talk about that as far as this great personal tragedy being framed as a part of God's calling your life for ministry. Perhaps you can give us that by way of framing this.
Yeah, so I had been, there are sort of two streams. I spoke to you about one. The other one was I've been doing a lot of reading in pastors from the 1800s. That's really my sweet spot in reading. I love those guys around the Spurgeon era. And just the way they wrote, the way they preached has been very meaningful to me. And one of the things I noticed as I read them was they dealt with a lot of grief in that era. A lot more children died. Mortality rates were amongst young people were higher. And so this was a very common thing for them to have to contend with. And one of the things they pushed again and again in their preaching and their pastoral counsel was something along the lines of, I'm very sorry that this happened to you, genuinely sorry, and take time to grieve. On the other hand, life is short and the call is urgent, and you can't allow this to take you right out of the race. This isn't the end of your calling in life, this great sorrow. But if you truly love the Lord and truly acknowledge his sovereignty in all things, then you have to understand that ultimately this has come from the hand of God. Ultimately, this is his will for you, and you need to accept it and then turn it outward into ministry toward others. That doesn't necessarily mean starting a formal grief ministry, but just in your own little circle and then wider circles as God gives it to you, move outward and bring comfort to other people through what you've gone through. And then I did have a friend as well who reached out and really affirmed that in a very specific way, a friend who had been very close to me for quite some time and just reached out and said, look, you've been doing all this writing and preaching, you've been a pastor in your church, you've been eldering, this is all good stuff, but this is what God has been calling you to. This is the moment God's been preparing you for. This will be the greatest sermon you've ever preached, is just your love for the Lord through this time of loss and this time of difficulty. And so I found that tremendously motivating and sort of like Calvin took Farrell's word as just God's own guidance in his life. That's sort of how I took it. Just this was the Lord's way of communicating to me that this was his will and I wasn't to contend against his will, but to embrace it.
So I want to tease out here momentarily the whole kind of permission to grieve. But before I get to that, do you see now, and I know you do, providentially before the Lord took Nick, things you look back and see providentially the Lord was doing in your life, your family, his life, that make more sense now, perhaps?
Yeah, absolutely. I think God had prepared us. So one of the conversations I've been having with my wife in the lead up to this, and not in the weeks before, but in the couple of years before, I said, as I read, as I study the word, I see that Christians are very often called to grieve. We're called to endure hard things. Our life has not been hard. We've really just received constant blessings. And I think, A, we need to not take that for granted. And B, we need to make sure we're preparing ourselves for times of suffering, because that just seems such a steady theme in Scripture and in the reading I'm doing, that there must be something coming at some point. And then sure enough, in relatively quick order, my father very unexpectedly died and went to be the Lord. And then very shortly after, Nick died and went to be with the Lord. And so I think we've been preparing ourselves in that way. Meanwhile, as a church, we had just been preaching through the book of Job. And so the pastor had been preaching just the reality that we need to be, we need to expect to come to times of loss, and that in those times we'll be challenged to either go deeper into our faith with the Lord or to just jettison it all together and say, I might have been called to be saved by God, but I wasn't called to suffer for God, or this wasn't what I signed up for when I became a Christian. And so just toss your faith altogether. So I think that was in our minds as we went into this time of grief.
In that time of grief, deep late fall of 2020, you have the reality of COVID, the displacement, the distances, part of that. I would assume that had to accentuate the difficulty because of just limitations on being with people, with family, with God's people, inability to travel. Give us a sense contextually how that was.
Yeah, it was very, very hard. So we were able to get into the United States because we were able to fly across the border. But when we returned to Canada, we had to quarantine for 2 weeks. And in those early days, you know, then my daughter wanted to go back down to school because she wanted to be there. And and every time we traveled, we'd have to quarantine. Sometimes in the States, we'd have to quarantine when we went back. And it was just my family all lives in the United States, so they could not come to the funeral. My wife's family was very concerned about COVID, so they didn't come to the funeral. So if you had ever told me your son will die and at the funeral, none of your family will be present, I would not have believed it. In the end, my mom was there, but none of the other family was able to be. They just couldn't get across the border. So it was a bizarre set of circumstances and one that I don't think we'll ever see again, but had its own way of, you know, it did a lot of things. What it really did was showed us the absolute centrality of the local church in our lives, in our suffering, in our sorrow, because even though our family was on the far side of a border and couldn't be present, the local church did their absolute utmost to be as present as they could be under the circumstances and to care for us well. So we were so thankful for our church and depended very heavily upon them.
We all, to some degree, have a working theory of when we see someone suffer loss, we tend to think how that must feel. And then when one goes through some deep valley of loss, that theory becomes, it collides with reality.
Yeah.
I guess help us to know what grief is actually like and what we should expect and what you processed and how you processed.
Sure. Yeah, we learned a few things. We learned that grief is absolutely overwhelming in its early days, or at least the grief of losing a parent, losing a child, losing a sibling, somebody who's very close to you. That grief can be absolutely overwhelming, and it really can dominate your life in such a way that you become unable to do normal things in a normal way. And so in those early days, we needed people to cook for us and just help us with very basic skills. I realized quickly I had no capacity to make good decisions. Both of my wife and I started making weird decisions or buying weird things. And it was just our minds were so scattered. And so I talked to a friend and said, I'm not going to make any decisions without bouncing them off you first, because I just don't trust myself in this time. Another thing we learned is that everybody grieves a little bit differently. And so my wife grieved like a woman. She grieved like a mother. I grieved like a man and like a father. And those were quite different. My two girls are quite different from one another, and they both grieved in their own way as well. And so we found you have to have a lot of patience for the way another person grieves. Give them time and space to grieve in their own way, rather than assuming everybody's grief should look like your own. And so in the very practicalities of it, and I think this would be generally true, is a man who's lost a son tends to be getting back to a new kind of normal faster than a mother who's lost a son or a daughter. And it's in that between period of time when dad's sort of saying, okay, I'm ready to press on with life now, and mom's not there yet, that there can be a lot of tension in marriage. And you hear divorce rates into the 80% range when you've lost a child. And I think a lot of that comes where one person is more ready to get back to the business of living life and the other isn't. And you can really judge each other and be cruel to each other, even inadvertently, unlovingly.
You mentioned reading in the 19th century and just how familiar people were with grief, because the infant mortality rate was so high, you know, the death rate in general was so high.
Yeah.
Modern medicine had not yet made its way to us. And so death was a constant factor.
Yeah.
And so grief was a way of life. You've come now to the 21st century, infant mortality rate's low, people live longer, modern medicine. Before you even get to kind of the psychotherapeutic generation we're in, to where folks want grief to be distant. Mm. I think you can even see that in the way funeral services themselves have been reimagined and all the rest. This hit home for me in recent months and years when my father-in-law and my father both passed away here recently. And as I was talking to both my mother-in-law and my mother, and both of them in their doctor's appointments, the very next appointment they had with their physician, their physicians, two different physicians, both preemptively prescribed for them antidepressants. Mm. It wasn't requested by them, but your husband died 3 months ago. Okay, here you go.
Wow.
And that was just the default position that you should be on this prescription medication for your depression. And there's a whole different places we could go with that. But for me, the takeaway was that the modern sensibility is like, you should not experience grief. I remember talking to my mom before that doctor's appointment, like 4 or 6 weeks after my dad passed. She was lamenting the sadness she felt, and not just for feeling the sadness, but for feeling like guilt over her grief. It's like, Mom, Dad just died 6 weeks ago.
Yeah.
You should be grieving. You should not feel bad about grief. And so, again, you've had to live this in such an acute way. Give us a sense as to Scripture presents grief, what you've learned historically from grief, how you've had to process that personally, and then in a broader context of a society, a culture, a generation that wants nothing to do with grief.
Yeah, I mean, I learned the value of a good Christian funeral. There was it was such a blessing to be able to lay Nick to rest in a historical way, using historical words that the church has long used, and to be able to really express the fact that it's true. Death is evil. Death is an evil intruder into this world, and therefore we rightly grieve. It's good to grieve. It's the right and appropriate response to death, and it's okay to feel the depth of grief. On the other hand, you want to see some progress in your grief, some sense of progression where maybe you're not measuring day by day, but am I doing better this week than last week? Or am I a little more able? Have I regained some capabilities this month versus last month? Or have I learned to laugh again? Am I finding things funny? Those sorts of things, I think, are helpful. So you don't want to get locked in this spiral of grief. And some people talk to us about the grief vortex, where you just kind of go down this cycle and it gets worse and worse and worse. And that can happen. You can get really in your head and really just fail to move forward. But I think the path forward we found involved submission, just submitting to God and speaking even out loud and just saying to God, you did nothing wrong. I think we can feel a sense of betrayal when we go through something really hard. We expect our parents will die when we're old. So maybe if we're 60 and our parents are in their 80s, we don't feel that sense of betrayal. But when we're in our teens and our father dies, or we're, you know, our young child dies, I think we can feel kind of betrayed by God that this isn't the way it was supposed to be. And so we need to come to the sense in our own hearts of God did nothing wrong. This is my father's world. He is the one who gives life. He is the one who has the right to take life away. And so once we submit to God in that and say, you did no wrong. In fact, I'm willing to believe the promises of Romans 8:28 that all things are working for good, and that if I had the knowledge you have, I would have done the same thing. However we want to express that, once we come to that point of submission to God, then I think we're well on the path to healing and to being able to press on joyfully.
As a father and husband, of course, you have an additional layer of responsibility. Give us a sense how you're leading your family in those early days and weeks and months, and both your wife and then your two daughters.
Yeah, I realized very early on in the first hours, really, that if ever my family had needed me, it was going to be now. And so if I wanted to be a leader in my home, if I wanted to be a godly husband, a godly father, I wasn't allowed to check out. In fact, this was where I needed to lead. Just like a general, you know, he can lead in peacetime, but when war comes, that's when he really needs to prove his mettle. And it was the same when it came to this loss, that I still had to grieve, but I couldn't grieve in such a way that I became useless to the people who needed my love, needed my guidance, needed me to be the spiritual head in the home. And so I think God was very kind to allow me to press on with that. And that involved, you know, my oldest daughter had been present. She had watched her brother die. And that was very, very traumatizing for her. So she knew she needed some counseling and was able to get that. And that was very helpful to her. For my other daughter, she was not present at the time, but was kind of stuck at home through COVID times with two parents who were really not functioning well. So that was very difficult. So trying to help her through that. And then, of course, my wife, who was just so wounded by it. And just grieving as a mother grieves. I don't think I had understood how much more deeply a woman feels than a man until we endured this together. And of course, we're both feeling it. But her capacity to feel, her capacity to grieve, I think was much deeper than my own. But of course, that child had lived within her and had nursed at her breast. And so this relationship was very different.
Give us a sense, now that we're a little over 4 years removed, just kind of chronologically, as you lead your family, as you process your own grief, kind of as months turn into years, what that has looked like for you emotionally, spiritually, at every level.
Yeah, time doesn't heal all wounds, but it sure does help. Just getting distance from the loss really is important. As you gain that distance, you gain better perspective. And God does do a work within you, and he works by the Spirit through the Word. Not only that, but I think you begin to find that sense of purpose in it. And once you bow the knee to God and say, you did no wrong in taking my son or taking my father or whoever it is, then you're able to say, now, what would you like me to do with this? How can I serve your purposes with this burden you've given me? If we really believe that God isn't giving these things uselessly or purposelessly, then we can say, what might his purpose be in it? And how can I turn this loss outward? Who needs to hear the comfort that I can bring them? And just like you can be sure God will send you comforters in the early days, you can be sure that God will want you to be a comfort in their days of grief. And so being able to take that loss and use it to express love to God by serving others, I think is a big part of the healing process as well.
So let's talk about that. You taking the loss and using it to serve others. For you, that began to get, you began to give expression to that through writing articles at first. Mm-hmm. And you chose to, frankly, process in public a lot of what you were experiencing. Talk about that decision. And then as that unfolded, what you experienced through it.
Yeah, the early writing about the loss was out of necessity because people wanted information, family members, et cetera, and it was just the easiest place to put information. But then also I had for all these years just written about the Christian life. And what blogging does is, at least my form of blogging, is really just interpret the Christian life through the experience of one person. And So now I was going through this very difficult time, and I thought it would be disingenuous to just stop and not talk about it. So I spoke to my family about it, and they were willing to have me keep writing about it with the stipulation that I would tell my story, not theirs, because their story is not mine. We all have a different story of this path through grief. And so I decided just to start telling my story and sharing my experience of it. And that eventually folded into what became a book. The book is made up of some of those writings, but also original writings. And as I look back at the book now, 5 years after I wrote it, or 4 years after I finished it, I'm thankful that I wrote it when I did, because the reflections on grief have an urgency that has become lost over time. In fact, 5 years on, Nick is becoming almost a kind, it hurts me to even say it, but almost a distant memory. He's fading into the past. And that's very hard for me to admit, but I can't hear the sound of his voice as I used to. And there's probably been a day that's gone by now when I haven't thought about him. And so that's just time. That's the process of time. That's what happens to all of us. The grief we at first think will be absolutely prominent and present for every moment of the rest of our lives does begin to fade, and we do press on through life. But I'm glad I wrote what I did at that time, because I think I captured an urgency that I couldn't go back and recreate now.
Theologically, what truths did you find most sustaining? I mean, obviously the sovereignty of God, but what else?
Yeah, the sovereignty of God. I was so thankful that I had been well-trained. I had grown up in the Reformed tradition. My parents had forced me to memorize all sorts of catechism questions and answers. And of course, I resented it at the time, but was I ever glad in that moment to know what is my only comfort in life and death, that it's not my own, that I belong body and soul, both in life and death, my faithful Savior, Jesus Christ. And if that was true of me, I knew it was true of my son. So I was glad to have been well taught. My wife came to faith when she was 18 years old. I led her to the Lord. And right away in the church we went to at the time, they said, catechism class, that's what you need. And so she got that doctrinal grounding as well. And so the sovereignty of God was so precious to us. That can be a cold doctrine, but when you're in grief, when you're in a time when your whole world has been rocked, it's not a cold doctrine anymore. Now it's an absolute necessity, and it really is life-giving and sustaining. And then hand in hand with that is the goodness of God, that God's sovereignty is not capricious, it's not arbitrary, it's not meaningless, that God is good, and that God exercises his sovereignty in ways that are consistent with the goodness of his character. And therefore, we can see that even if God's sovereignty gave us something extremely difficult, something we would never have imagined, never had chosen, we can still believe that it was in some way an expression of his goodness, because God can't not be good. He can't be evil. And so somehow we just had to believe there was good in this. And that was so helpful to us to be able to hold those two truths together.
Textually, you mentioned Romans 8:28. Is there any other passage of scripture that's become particularly dear to you?
Yeah, that Romans 8:28. So I've often heard, don't bring Romans 8:28 early in grief. And I think there may be wisdom in that, but I wanted to drink deeply of that immediately. That was so precious to me to know that this wasn't meaningless, that God, even this, God could and would work for good. That was so helpful to me. So I would be, you know, you got to be careful. You don't just bring that and slam it down on the hospital bed. But there may be times when that is a precious truth to bring to somebody who's in grief. And Psalm 23 was just incredibly meaningful to me, which is almost cliche to say, but just such a wonderful psalm, and just brought truths to bear that were so precious. Like the fact that it's not, David is speaking about God, but it's in the valley of the shadow of death. He starts speaking to God, that God's there present with him. And just that little observation was so helpful to me. Or even knowing that it was the good shepherd who had led the sheep into the valley of the shadow of death. This wasn't the wandering sheep who had gone astray. This was the good shepherd leading him through this difficult place to get to the joys beyond. And that was tremendously meaningful to me.
Congregationally, you mentioned your local church and how essential mm-hmm. that they were and have been through this process.
Yeah.
Elaborate on that a touch. And I mean, not just kind of the human acts of kindness and service, but just public worship, mm-hmm. being together with God's people. Elaborate on those dynamics.
Yeah. So we were, again, in COVID times, our building was unavailable to us. So we weren't able, and we had to go into several quarantines. So we didn't get a lot of time with our church until several weeks after Nick died. But when we did, it almost surprised us to realize that it had been the church's loss and not just our loss. To see the church grieving was very powerful to us. To realize that he was a son of the church and he'd been taken from us as a congregation, not just us as a family. And to see other people grieving that loss was so meaningful to us and so helpful in us processing the grief to know that we were cared for by them. And then 1 year later, on the first anniversary of his death, we went to the cemetery. By that time, restrictions had been lifted, so we could go to the cemetery and have a little worship service there and just invited the church to come. And that was a huge blessing to us as well, to be able to do then some of what we hadn't been able to do in those early days with all their restrictions.
The book, Seasons of Sorrow, give us a sense of what you're hoping to accomplish through it. And what, as we would read it, what you hope our main takeaways are.
Mm-hmm. I think the main thing I wanted to show was progress through the first year. And so the book is divided into seasons, and the seasons are both literal and metaphorical, kind of leading from the cold of winter to the warmth of summer, metaphorically, but then also that was the first year of our path through grief. And just trying to lead people, show people that process. So A, they can identify it in others. And when somebody else is going through loss, I think there would be things you would recognize in the experience I described there. But then also hoping to give people a sense that Christians can progress through their most difficult times and emerge not just with their faith intact, but with their faith strengthened. And not just with their love for the Lord enduring, but their love for the Lord amplified through that time of grief. And that was my experience and very much the experience of my wife and my girls. So, you know, especially with girls who are 17 and 14 at the time, you don't really know what their faith is made of. And you don't know when they encounter something as grievous as the loss of a brother and, you know, eyewitness of the loss of a brother, will they just say, that's it, I'm done with this Jesus thing if that's what it's going to cost me? Or will they go all deeper and just depend upon him and really prove their faith? And what a blessing as a father to see my wife and my girls all emerge from that, loving the Lord and praising his name, even with hearts that were broken and shattered.
Tim, as we pull this together, final couple questions. I want to talk about just how we best serve and support and minister to those who are in seasons of catastrophic loss. Hundreds of us in the room are ministering in a local church context or will be ministering in a local church context. We will surely encounter church members who are in an acute season of loss. And I'm sure certain things said, certain deeds done were particularly helpful. Mm. I'm sure some things said and some deeds done were less helpful. Yeah. And so give us a sense how best to minister as what we should say and do, and frankly, what we should not say or not do.
Sure. I think one thing to generally avoid is to ask people about the circumstances of the death. And that's often because people want to either convince themselves that that can never have happened to them, which can feel like you're downplaying or blaming the parents, or it can be because you want to attach it to some sort of a political cause or some other cause that's important to you, which then cheapens the person's death. And so I can just give you an example of this. Out on the internet, there's all sorts of people writing about my son's death was caused by a COVID vaccine because he died during COVID. The COVID vaccine hadn't been released yet, so that timing doesn't work out. He did not have a vaccine, but that was an example of people saying, A, it couldn't have happened to me because I didn't get the vaccine, or to my children because we didn't have it. But also, here's a cause that I believe in, which is, you know, I'm against the vaccine, and here's an example of why I am. And that was very hurtful to us when it came at us. People come up to us at conferences or when we were out and about and just kind of bring that to bear, like we had done something wrong. And so instead of grieving with people, you're now offending them. And that can be true when somebody's taken their own life. If you're approaching, how did he die? Well, maybe he committed suicide and the family's feeling a deep sense of shame about that. Or there may be they have experienced some trauma with that. And so just be very careful asking about the circumstances. If it's just curiosity, then you don't need to know that information. If it is essential to your comfort for the family, that might be different. Another thing is a phone call is better than a text message, and being present is better than a phone call. We're very used to just dashing off a text message, you know, sorry for your loss. And maybe that's the best you can do under the circumstances, or maybe that's appropriate under the circumstances. But there are a couple of young men in our church who would call us A couple of young ladies in our church, too, actually, who would call us even a year later and just say, hey, I'm praying for you today. I just want to know how you're doing. That was so meaningful when an 18-year-old young man calls you just to say he just wants to hear how you're doing. Huge, huge blessing, even more so than if he was a 38-year-old man. There's just something so thoughtful and endearing about that. So the ministry of presence, I think, is very important, being there, caring. And, you know, as you have opportunity to serve people, if they've gone through a very hard loss, like the loss of a parent, the loss of a child, something like that, understanding that their capacity to live life might be vastly reduced. And so maybe offering to bring them meals or do their shopping for them or do their laundry for them or drive their kids to classes or wherever they need to be. Life can be very, very overwhelming to those who are deep in grief. And so making yourself available to help them and even suggesting specific ways to help, I think, can be a real blessing to people, a way you can help share that burden. And then the last one I would say is keep track of anniversaries. So if somebody's father has died, write in your phone or wherever you put these things, the date of that death. And then a year later, get in touch or send flowers and just say, hey, thinking of you today on that anniversary, or maybe their birthday as well, the birthday of the person who's died. Just get in touch with the family and say, praying for you today. It's probably a hard day. Love you. Praying for you. And I think that can be really helpful to people as well.
Well, we really appreciate your book. And again, the conversation today and the way the Lord has called you to steward all of this for the betterment of the church. For those who want the book, where can they find it?
Wherever books are sold.
Do you have a preferred place you like on your website or?
No, I don't sell it through my website directly. So wherever you want to buy books, you'll find it there.
Okay. And it's published, is it Thomas Nelson?
Zondervan.
Yep. Okay. So published by Zondervan, mm-hmm. Seasons of Sorrow. Tim, we really appreciate it.
Yeah.
Really appreciate you being here with us today.
Thank you for being with us today and for listening to Preaching and Preachers. For more information, go to my website, jasonkallen.com. That's jasonkallen.com.